4th, and welcome to your Senate Committee on Rules. Senator Burdick is planning on joining us to testify on Senate Bill 201. I'm sorry? She's running a little late, so we're going to go ahead and do executive appointments first. It's my understanding that the... it's not on the agenda. Do we need to set anything over? On a regular morning.
There is a revised agenda.
Okay. I have too many agendas.
But you can announce it.
Okay.
All right.
What's the number
of
We're going to carry over SCR 6 until amendments are available, is my understanding, and I anticipate that may be on Tuesday. And with that, I'll open a public hearing and work session on executive appointments and ask Ms. Lindy Fisker and Christine Lewandowski to come forward, and one is on the phone. I just remembered that. So, okay. Good morning, and if you hang on just a minute, I'm going to connect to... on the phone here.
Okay, thank you.
What did I do with the number? You gave it to me.
It's right here.
Too many pieces of paper. Okay, what did I do with it, you guys?
I
didn't put it in my pocket.
There you go.
Thanks. Shut up.
It's 9-1.
I may be.
This is brave. I would never do this as a chairman of a committee. I'd always have staff do this.
Technological impaired, but I figured how the pedometer works.
I did too. It goes in a drawer.
Hi, is this Ms. Lewandowski?
Yes, it is.
Did I say your last name right?
Yes, it is.
Great. Well, welcome. I just opened the public hearing and possible work session on executive appointments. It's my understanding that you are going to be reappointed, assuming the Senate it confirms your reappointment to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you wish to continue to serve on this commission?
Well, thank you for having me by telephone this morning. Members of the committee. I'm 55 years old. I live here in Eugene. I previously served on the Commission for Children and Families here in Lane County, and previously also worked for Eugene Municipal Court. During my time as a commissioner, I also served on the West University Task Force after the riots that occurred here at the university. So I have some information and background during the time that I served relating to how alcohol impacts our communities, and particularly here in Eugene. For that reason alone, I have been interested in serving on the commission since Eugene has the University of Oregon. I'm also a parent of a 14-year-old, and so my interest goes beyond just society, but how it impacts in the family and in the schools. I found it very, very interesting serving on the commission because alcohol being a legal commodity in our state and a business that is operated by the state, there's a real balancing act, I think, for the commission in all the decisions that we make. And I feel that I continue to be involved and want to be involved in making those decisions.
Thank you. Ms. Fisker, would you please introduce yourself for the record and tell us why you want to be on the Oregon Liquor Control, continue to serve on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Committee on Rules. My name is Lindy Fisker, and I am before you this morning seeking confirmation for a second four-year term as a commissioner on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I reside at 15409 Northeast Fargo Place in Portland in Senator Frank Shields' district. In 1990, I graduated from Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College, and I believe I was one year behind Senator Charlie Ringo there. And I was admitted to the Oregon State Bar that same year.
We won't hold that against you.
I was admitted to the Oregon State Bar that same year in September. I worked for the City of Portland as a deputy city attorney for 4 years, representing the Bureau of Buildings, the Bureau of License, and the Police Bureau Drug and Vice Division. My responsibilities included representing the City of Portland in litigation at administrative hearings, arbitration, circuit court, and matters on appeal. I had the opportunity to appear and successfully argue before the Oregon Supreme Court. In 1994, I was hired by Portland General Electric Company and continued to be employed with PGE. It is with the support of PGE that I am able to volunteer my time as a commissioner to the OLCC. During my 10 years with PGE, I've held many positions within the company and currently work in the area of federal regulatory affairs and compliance. My legal background and professional experience are transferable skills that have served me well as an OLCC commissioner. In 2001, former Governor John Kitzhaber appointed me to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And during my 4 years as a commissioner, the agency has increased liquor sales, which are generating more money for the general fund. We've approved Sunday sales, began a pilot program of a store within a store operations. And we've accomplished these innovative goals while maintaining, enforcing, and developing higher standards for the responsible use of alcohol. I've developed many relationships with OLCC business partners, staff, and stakeholders. And Chairman Lang, along with the other commissioners, value our excellent work and relationship with Executive Director Teresa Kaiser and her staff that allows for an open and transparent dialogue on all relevant issues that protect the various interests of Oregon citizens. I'd like to continue working with OLCC because I think we have many challenging issues that are still before us. Again, as a mother of an 11-year-old, I'm concerned with underage drinking, the advertisement that we think is focused on our children, how we can continue to protect our youth from that, to make sure that we are responsible outlets for the use of alcohol. Because we have those issues before us, I'd like to continue to provide my support, volunteer my time and expertise in the areas. Thank you for your time and attention. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. And for the record, I received a letter from Representative Jeff Merkley, which I'll briefly read. Dear Senators, my constituent, Valencia Visker, is seeking reappointment to the OLCC. Her reappointment will be before your committee in the next week or two. Ms. Visker was initially appointed by Governor Kitzhaber in April of 2001. She has dutifully served in this voluntary capacity since that time. During her 4 years, the Commission has increased distilled spirit sales, which generated more revenue for the general fund. Please give Ms. Visker every consideration for reappointment. Sincerely, Jeff Merkley. So a couple of questions for both of you. I'm very concerned about the ability of cities and neighborhood associations to provide meaningful input on proposed liquor licenses. I introduced a bill, Senate Bill 457, which will increase the comment period for cities from 45 to 60 days and for neighborhood associations from 30 to 45 days. And just want to get your thoughts on whether the both of you think this is a workable proposal. And Ms. Lewandowski, would you please respond first since we've got you on the phone?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The bill that has been introduced certainly is something that, as members of the commission, we would like to support. It definitely falls in line with the information that we received and the time allotted for those neighborhood committees to respond to the commission. We take their input as very substantive to making our decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Fisker.
I would agree with Commissioner Lewandowski. We have no opposition, or actually we're in support of increasing the time frame for review. As long as we can have the temporary letter of authority that would go along with that so as not to in any way disadvantage the licensee, and that's similar to our House Bill 2056.
Which I am aware of. Thank you. Ms. Lewandowski, do you have any other thoughts on how we can better include the public, particularly, and I don't know how true this is in Eugene and other cities, but Portland has such a, shall I say, extremely active neighborhood association process, how we can include citizens in the license approval process?
Well, that is a very difficult question and situation that we face all the time as to how much weight we put on neighborhood associations, because here in Eugene, we don't have a great deal of neighborhood associations, but my experience listening to the associations in the Portland area is each one of those neighborhood groups are formed differently. And sometimes we don't know as a commission how many within the neighborhood are actually speaking for the full community there. So many of the issues that come up seem to be raised in a manner that is unclear to us as to, I want to say, the clear direction from the community. Each one is different. And so we have to take it on a situation basis when we make our decisions. But we do weigh all that information from the neighborhoods. We do see that as important information before we make our decisions. To answer your question, I don't know how we can change that. I really feel like it's up to the neighborhoods to come together in a manner that's maybe a little bit more uniform that we can recognize when we make our decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Fisker. Do you wish to respond?
Yes, I agree. We are met with some challenges in the Portland area as we continue to urbanize there, but we understand the importance of the neighborhood associations through the city of Portland. We have done some outreach in that last year we had a roundtable forum with representatives from the neighborhood association and the city officials that came in and were able to carry on a dialogue with the commissioners about some of their concerns. What we find, as Commissioner Lewandowski stated, is that there's not uniformity when they come before us or clarity as to who they're really representing at the time, whether or not they're speaking on behalf of their neighborhood association or just as a concerned neighbor in the particular area. So we'd like to see some uniformity in their approach to us. And also we've done some outreach in that we've had a person from staff, from OLCC staff, that has gone out to the various neighborhood associations and attended their meetings to try and educate and inform them as to what our regulatory authority is and what we can consider when we're trying to determine whether or not to issue a license. And there are just some areas that OLCC cannot take into consideration when we are determining whether or not to issue or renew a license. And I think the more the neighborhood associations understand what our authority is, the better they'll feel that we are taking into consideration their concerns.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Glad to see you.
Thank you.
This morning. I guess I have a question. It would be of both of you. During the interim, I chaired the General Government Committee, and we had the OLCC come and explain to us the new pilot program.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. We were a little concerned about the process that was used in getting there and whether there was enough of a consultative nature to that process. One of my biggest concerns, however, is not the process itself, but whether we remain as well controlled as we have been with this change. I'd like you to both respond a little bit to the control factor. Maybe my statistics are dated, I don't know, but last time I knew, control states were better off in terms of alcoholism rates versus open states and such things as that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just make some general comments about how that project went and how you see it working in terms of keeping the equilibrium that I think Oregon needs.
Ms. Lewandowski, could you hear that question?
The pilot program that decided to embark upon, when first presented to us, I recognized the fact that, first of all, it's a model that we currently use in Oregon. It's not a new model. Straw Hackers up in Portland uses the store within a store. Sun River does also. And since I've been on the commission, there has been many people who have come to me and wanted to, and through our surveys also, recognize the fact that they really wanted a little bit more pleasant, convenient locations. Because of the population growth, particularly in the Portland area, I feel like we've been behind the ball when it came to opening new outlets for the convenience of the public. And since this is a pilot program, I think we have 2 years to learn from it. As far as the process, it can always be made better, more efficient. At the time that we decided on the pilot program, we had a new director who was still learning her feet, and we all were. So I see this as an opportunity really to see some new ways of doing business here in Oregon. And from what I'm hearing, with the existing pilots that we have opened, is nothing but a plus. In my area here, we have, particularly one I'm thinking of, we have a liquor agent right next to Fred Meyer in our River Road area. And the only difference that distinguishes that store from a store within a store is the location of the front door. Mm-hmm. The liquor agent, her agency sits right next to Fred Meyer, and the exterior door to that agent is from the street. If the door is closed to the inside of Fred Meyer, or someone had to go through the front door of Fred Meyer and then into the liquor store agent, the only difference is the front door. In my mind, when it comes to controlling alcohol, that makes two hurdles for a minor to have to cross, not just one. But adding that extra hurdle, I believe, keeps more alcohol controlled, not less.
Thank you, Ms. Fisker. Do you wish to respond?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, in determining whether or not to go forward with this pilot program, the commissioners heavily weighed the convenience with the public safety issue. And because we are it will be a limited pilot program, we have the right to say this isn't going to be in the public interest at the end if we make that determination. And to help us do that, we have commissioned Portland State University to conduct a survey for us to determine what the public sentiment is, what the safety impacts have been. The preliminary results have been that the public appreciate the convenience. They do not see it as an adverse impact to the public, but again, we will wait until the conclusion of the pilot program to make a final determination as to whether or not to continue this as a potential convenience for agent locations. Oregon was behind in opening new agencies. We did find that there were a need for more additional outlets, and we find that this is a way to do it that provides public convenience.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Senator Shields.
Yeah, I guess two comments, and I'd give you an opportunity just to respond to them. Number one, I do have in my hands a letter that you all got from one of my colleagues in the Senate who expressed concern that it was done pretty much in the dark and that there wasn't as much public press releases and so on, and people didn't know that this was coming, and it happened kind of quickly. So as you get the results, even if they're not totally encased the way you want them, I would hope that you would make those results, make the public aware step by step of what the process is and how you're thinking this through and so on and so forth. The second thing, though, might be just the old man in me or something. You kind of wonder, and you use the example of Fred Myers and the position of the front door and so on. The store within the store, what keeps it from being a store within the store this year and a few years from now moving to being just on the shelf of the store rather than being the store within the store? I mean, is there a reason to worry about incrementalism here? Go ahead.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Shields. We are a controlled state. The commissioners believe that we should continue as a controlled state, and we did not start the pilot store within a store concept to get away or to move closer to privatization. We are committed to being a controlled state, and we think that the way that we have set up the parameters of the store within a store, that we will continue to be controlled. There are benefits to being controlled. I think we are more responsible as a controlled state. Public safety always is a forefront issue and major concern for us, and the commissioners are committed to staying in that. Hindsight is always 20/20, and could we have had more public process and input and more notices that we were trying to roll out this pilot program? We probably could have. And as we get the results back from our survey, we'd be more than happy to share that with the public and our business partners. We've done an incredible amount of outreach with our new executive director, Teresa Kaiser, in extending ourselves to our partners and our stakeholders and make sure that there is a free flow of information, and we will definitely do that with this pilot program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Do you wish Ms. Lewandowski to respond, or was that adequate?
It's up to her.
Do you wish to respond as well?
I would just like to add, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that to reiterate what Commissioner Fisker said, I agree with her. Also, that it's not necessarily up to us, but also the legislature, whether privatization occurs or not. And it's been shown in the past, the last two sessions, that the legislature and the public do not want to see the alcohol industry privatized in the state of Oregon. And we support that. So I think as a commissioner, I do not see where the state is going to store will get to the point where it's going to be privatizing alcohol.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Farinelli?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I very much appreciate the questions from the good senator from Gresham, East
Portland, whatever it is.
Somewhere. but I think that the Eastern Oregon audience have a difficult time understanding how to get your mind around this question, because the liquor store in Arlington is a hardware store.
Mm-hmm.
The liquor store in Bayville is a grocery store. The liquor store in Cascade Locks is a hardware store, and the liquor store in Prairie City is a drugstore / hardware store. So Eastern Oregonians have long been used to purchasing alcohol, horseshoe nails, bacon, molasses, cake mix, eggs, and ammunition from the same shelves, from the same vendor. And there is an attempt, I suppose, at a store within a store. It's one aisle back. And I don't know why Oregonians, perhaps rural Oregonians are more responsible than Western Oregonians or urban Oregonians. I kind of doubt it. But it seems like this need for process has become somewhat pathological. I mean, I understand that this was a kind of a decision that sort of popped out of the process without a lot of run-up to it. I also think the public may need to know that the issue of control is much more an issue for beer and wine, and keeping access to by Oregonian youth to alcohol is more an issue of distribution of beer and wine than it ever has been an issue of spirits, although I think the perception is that Demon Run is somehow, you know, entering into the drug of choice pattern with the teenagers. Just not true. But I do have a couple questions after having made those observations. Would you both please, Ms. Lewandowski and Ms. Fisker, talk about the Sunday sales program and whether or not you think that's been successfully implemented?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for asking that question, because the legislature a number of years ago okayed Sunday sales. And my understanding is that we have agents, particularly on the coast where tourism is their major income, where they wanted to have the option of having their store open on Sunday for tourists. What I think was a very wise decision on the legislature's part was that they kept it an option.
Right.
And so those who do not want to have their stores open on Sunday, for whatever reason, they don't have to have it open. So I really feel like at this point in time, it works very well.
Chair, Senator, I would agree again with Commissioner Lewandowski. The fact that it's an option and agents know their business and the routine of their customers better than the commissioners do, I think that it has worked very well. And those agents that want to open their stores on Sundays now have that option to do so, because they know that there is a demand for Sunday sales. And those that know that they do not have that demand in their particular stores are not forced to have their stores open and pay the cost of having someone there when they're not getting the business. So it's been very beneficial to the state of Oregon.
Senator Farrelly, further questions?
Madam Chairman, just the further observation, and finally one last question. I think if there are benefits, I have not seen any corresponding consequence of negative consequence in this approach. It seems to me that what we did was make the availability of access match the community pattern. So without any additional expenses for promotion, the sales have gone up measurably. It doesn't seem to have created a corresponding downside in terms of enforcement or violations issues. So I think it was a good decision, and optional is the key word here. Final question, Madam Chairman. The issue of equity for all CC agents has been one that I think has been discussed, not dealt with. I talked to agents throughout the state. They indicate that they're perfectly willing to shoulder the burden as partners with the state in creating a safe environment for a controlled substance, which alcohol certainly is, and that they understand the responsibility to help create revenue for the state. But often they feel they're at an extreme disadvantage in their negotiations with the state for compensation. And I'd just like to hear the our two witnesses talk about whether or not they believe there needs to be the issue of compensation dealt with, and whether or not agents are equitably compensated.
Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems to come up during every session as far as the compensation for the agents, because as revenue grows, it seems only fair that their revenue grows also, and maybe the percentage that they get back for their efforts and their business skills, that they are compensated more for that. It seems only fair that as a state, when we expect more returns, that they also enjoy the benefits of that.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzka.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would agree with the comments of Commissioner Lewandowski.
Right. Anything further, Senator
Ferriero? Just an observation, Madam Chairman. I didn't hear Ms. Lewandowski tell me anything of substance. I think the thing keeps coming up during the legislative sessions because it doesn't seem to get dealt with in the interims. So I would just reiterate that I think the agents feel that they should participate in the increase in the revenue along with the distillers, the distillers agents, the distributors, and the state, because everybody in the curve is making more money.
Mm-hmm.
The products are much more expensive than they were in years past, and although it's a percentage kind of a game, we're asking them to do more. It just, I would doubt that the legislature will get into that issue as we have avoided it in the past. But I would just encourage the commission to listen carefully to the needs of the distributors, because they're the ones that were, or the agents, because they're the ones that were asking to shoulder the burden.
Thank you. Any further questions for these two? I just want to say thank you very much for taking time out of your work schedule to join us today, Ms. Lewandowski, to join us by phone today. We really appreciate the time and energy that you serve the state, and your service has been very valuable. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are in work session. The chair is going to move the governor's reappointments of Ms. Fisker and Ms. Lewandowski to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, that they be sent to the floor with a be confirmed en bloc recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Okay.
Sarah Atkinson, any comments? You're awfully quiet this morning. Okay. With that, I'll ask Ms. Nielsen to call the roll.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Ringo? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Who would like to carry these appointments? Senator Shields. That would be great. Thank you. Next, we're going to open up a public hearing and work session on the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. And I believe, Senator Betsy Johnson, do you wish to testify?
I do, Madam Chair.
Come on up, and then we'll bring up Robert Hidley. Mr. Hidley, why don't you come on up as well? And thanks for your patience.
No problem. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from Senate District 16. I'm here today because I think I have a unique set of perspectives that qualify me to speak on behalf of Mr. Hidley's confirmation. I spent my entire professional career as a commercial helicopter pilot and managing a helicopter company located in Scappoose, serving the western United States. I ran the agency Mr. Hidley will run, if confirmed, for 5 years. I was the godmother of the creation of the Oregon Department of Aviation and have maintained a keen interest in the department since its creation in the 99 session. And finally, I served on the interview panel that ultimately brought Mr. Hidley before the governor for appointment and before you and our other Senate colleagues for confirmation. I came today to tell you it was a very public process that had a great deal of citizen involvement in the selection. The committee that interviewed the candidates and finally recommended Mr. Hidley represented all aspects of the aviation community. I might also add that Joe Wall of the Department of Administrative Services did a superior job of managing the entire recruitment process. I've had the opportunity to review Mr. Hidley's credentials. I've had a chance to get to know him. I believe he's exactly what the agency needs right now, and I'm here this morning to offer my unqualified recommendation for his confirmation. Thank you.
Questions for the Senator? Senator Atkinson.
Senator, this agency started in 1999, and you ran it for 5 years till last year?
Actually, I ran it when it was still part of the Department of Transportation. I was the head of then what was the Aeronautics Division of ODOT from 1993 to 1998 when I resigned. And then I, as a private citizen, actively lobbied the creation of a freestanding Department of Aviation, and that was successfully accomplished in the 99 session.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Has Mr. Hidley testified?
He has not.
Okay. Any further questions for Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, with your permission, I'm due someplace else, and so I'm going to entrust Mr. Hidley into your tender care and excuse myself.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us this morning. Mr. Hidley, fire away.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Bob Hidley. I'm very happy to be here. I've had an interest in aviation since I was a boy building model airplanes, and later on when I grew up, I got my private license for flying while I was just finishing high school. Went on to get a degree in aviation administration and then joined the Air Force and flew for them. And most of my time I spent in Spokane, Washington, which is why my wife and I like the Pacific Northwest so much and would like to come back here. After I was done with active duty, I went into airport management, and I was both a director and assistant director of four different airports for 11 years, and during that time I learned an awful lot about aviation, managing airports and organizations. Also, I felt accomplished a lot bringing new airlines, freight, and different businesses into my airports, helping economic development quite a bit. During that time, I was also in the reserves, so I was flying for them at the same time. And it got to be really a lot to do both, to both fly for the reserves and manage an airport. So I decided to leave airport management and go back into the reserves full time. And I did that and recently retired, which is why I'm here now. My last job in the Air Force, I was Assistant Director of Operations for 4th Air Force. That organization is responsible for 13 different bases around the country. 23 flying squadrons, about 22,000 people, including the tanker unit at Portland. So I learned a lot there also. So now I'm here. I'm very excited, and we're looking forward to doing a lot of things for Oregon and aviation.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Shields.
Is there a possibility you're overqualified for this job? Just teasing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you for coming. Where do you live right now?
In the Holiday Inn.
where do you live?
My house is in Marietta, California. It's north of San Diego. And we just received two offers last night for it, so we have a bidding war going on. And I've already signed an agreement to purchase a house here in Salem. So we'll be moving up here in about a month as soon as we get all that done.
Thank you. Madam, is there a residency requirement for this nomination?
Senator Atkinson, I'm getting heads nodding from the Director of Executive Appointments from the Governor's Office that there is not, and we'll have committee staff check that as well. But it's fairly clear, I think, Mr. Hidley, that you fully intend to reside in Oregon.
Yes, I do.
Particularly after you've seen what glorious weather we have during the winter.
Well, being washed away in California. So it's a lot better being here. No, I've already purchased a house here.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Hidley, the state airports represent a tremendous economic engine and a development engine and a critical component of our multimodal transportation system. Rural Oregonians have yet to see real investment by the state of Oregon in developing rural airports as part of the multimodal transportation network. There are hobby fields, there are leader ports, there are basically well-suited to commercial air, but we can't seem to get the state interested in the same sort of multimodal subsidies that we see for light rail and commuter rail in the Willamette Valley, for example. My argument is that when we have regular scheduled commercial air service to rural airports that are state-owned operations that are fully capable and fully equipped to take the small commuter air flights that we see as feeder lines, that's the day when we'll be able to do honest, genuine economic development recruitment for development of jobs in rural Oregon. And I'm just wondering if you'd care to comment on the idea of building the capability to have regular scheduled air service to some of the state-owned airports in rural areas.
Before you respond to that, I'd also like to echo that. My husband and I had a commuter marriage for the first year. It was a six-hour commute between basically Salem and Enterprise, Oregon, and we would have gladly have enjoyed the ability to fly for our weekend visit, so to speak. So also very aware of what a critical component this is for rural economic development. So.
And Madam Chairman,
Senator,
just a point of clarification. I remember driving you on at least two occasions. When I drove, it only took us 4.5 hours to get there.
That's because, well, I won't. Please respond.
Well, I agree with you. Aviation is critical to a community's development. You need to have air service to bring customers, employees, and the businesses in that community fly freight in and out. It's very important. And I've had a lot of experience developing that kind of thing in different communities. And the bottom line of the whole thing is the airline needs to be profitable. They need to be able to make a profit to come into a community. And there's lots of different ways of making it profitable for them. And the part of the state's role should be to do that, both making the airport standards well good enough so the airline can fly in there, or the air taxi, whatever it is, depending on the size of the community, and then also going after their service to bring it in. I've done a lot of that. And you're right, it's very important.
Madam Chairman, just to the issue really is whether or not airlines find that service to those remote and rural areas pencils out. In most cases, it does not. And there's been a variety of approaches, including guaranteed subsidies or buying seats. If it's done well, initially the subsidy is required to get the business started, but once people realize there's regular, scheduled, predictable service over a period of time that's definable, 5 years or better, people begin to rely on the air service and the subsidy becomes less and less a necessity. And I would just hope that we could explore the idea of really developing along the lines that they have in Australia, in Alaska, in New Zealand, and other places where time and distance are negative factors in economic development. My vote for the confirmation of this candidate will be predicated on his assertion that he'll help me get an honest discussion of the benefits of providing regular scheduled air service to rural Oregon.
I'm already talking about that idea with our board, and you're exactly right. In order to bring service in a small community, quite often you need to provide a subsidy to begin with. And we're talking about that idea where we start out with that, and then as the people in the area start using the airplane, you can start reducing the subsidy, but you want to make sure that the airline was profitable and would stay there. And yes, that's the same idea that we're working on.
Thank you,
Madam Chairman. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Are you serving right now as the acting director?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been doing that?
This is my second week. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Henley?
Thank you. We look forward to working with you. I know that there's some bills that might be of interest to you in terms of economic development in our small rural airports, and look forward to working with you on those bills. Thank you. Nothing further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are in work session on the executive appointment of Mr. Hibley to be director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. The chair would move the governor's appointment of Mr. Robert Hibley to the Oregon Department of Aviation director, that the appointment be sent to the floor with that it be confirmed and that it be confirmed. Thank you. I'm reading the wrong script. Any discussion? No, it's right. That's what I'm like. Block's not going to work here.
Madam Chair?
Senator Atkinson.
I'll be voting against this nomination. I believe Mr. Hibley will have a fantastic career here in Oregon and is overly qualified and will do a great job. But I have got reservations. We had a situation a few years back with someone in the... A nominee for the Fish and Wildlife Department that was from out of state, and it was a big issue because those issues were very important to Oregon, and we at that point made a vote based on that, and for me to be consistent,
I wish you've got the votes. You're going to be confirmed. You're going to do a great job and get out of the Holiday Inn. But I need to remain consistent, so that's where I'll be a no.
Thank you. Committee's going to be at ease for a couple minutes. On the floor. Okay, we can't find Senator Ringo. The motion on the floor is to approve the governor's appointment of Mr. Bob Hidley be sent to the floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Farioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. And who would like to carry this? Senator Farioli, would you like to?
Under the circumstance, Madam Chairman, I will be happy to carry the bill.
Okay.
If that's what you'd like me to do.
Well, carry the appointment.
The appointment.
Okay. Are you willing to do that?
I am.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much, Mr. Hidley. We appreciate you being here this morning. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 201. Senator Burdick, why don't you come on up? I understand Mr. Bill Perry and Ms. Lori Wimmer are under time constraints. If the two of you could come up as well.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Hi. Please proceed.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ginny Burdick. I represent the people of Senate District 18, which includes Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 201, which would deal with the problem known as ballot title shopping. It pertains to our initiative process, and that under ballot title shopping, sponsors of initiatives get the bare minimum requirement of 25 signatures to submit an initiative to the Secretary of State. And if they get a draft ballot title that they don't like or that they don't feel would poll well, and sometimes they actually do poll them, they submit another initiative on the same subject. I believe that this is an abuse of our initiative system, and I say this as a former chief petitioner. I actually did do my own ballot measure with a lot of other people involved, of course, back in 2000, Measure 5, otherwise known as the Good Measure 5, requiring background checks at gun shows. And I,
Sam Burke, I think that depends upon who's referring to the measure.
And I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that editorial comment, Ms. Madam Chair. In that case, I got back a ballot title, a draft ballot title that was really dreadful, that would not have been able to be used. And I went through the process that the law provides to provide comment to the Attorney General on the ballot title. The process was successful. I got back a ballot title that wasn't the way I would have written it, but at least it was clear on what the measure did. The measure went on to pass statewide by 62%. So it was a real success story for that initiative. And the key point here is that I submitted only one version of that initiative. We worked very hard to get what we thought was good policy. I had a team of law enforcement people working on that, and we felt that we came up with our very best product, went through the system. The system worked. The ballot title shopping is very costly for both the Attorney General's office and for the Supreme Court, which ends up dealing with all these ballot title issues and appeals. In the Supreme Court, I remember in 2000 when my measure was on, there were 92 appeals to the Supreme Court, and a lot of these were, you know, duplicate measures, etc. During that time period, I recall that the Supreme Court basically did nothing but ballot title challenges for 2 or 3 months, and that's we shouldn't be asking our Supreme Court to have that kind of a workload so that people can just, in my view, abuse the process like that. What this bill would do is require petitioners to get 10% of the signatures required before they can apply for a ballot title. I think that makes sense. There'll be another bill bill coming to this committee soon, Senate Bill 933, which is my version of the bill, which would halt the petition gathering process while the Attorney General's while a ballot title is being developed. So you get the first 10% based on a summary from the Attorney General, and then you would go through the ballot title process and get the other 90% based on the actual ballot title. Either of these approaches, and of course Senate Bill 201 would have all the signatures gathered based on the Attorney General's summary. Either one would be a vast improvement over the current system, and I think our initiative process needs to have integrity. It needs to not be used just to advance special interests who are just trying to go out and get the most popular ballot title they can find. I think it should be used to address policy issues. And again, this didn't really come up in 2003 as an argument when we did pass my measure through the Senate floor, but nowadays it's become very clear that a lot of these initiatives that end up on the ballot are very sloppily written, and we are dealing with one of those now, Measure 37, which has been very hard for people to understand. And I serve on a committee with Senator Ringo that we spend most of our time trying to figure out what the measure means, what improvements we can make to clarify it. I think ballot title shopping encourages sloppy drafting rather than discourages it. So this is good policy, Madam Chair. We did pass a version of this through the Senate in 2003, and I would really urge this committee to give us another chance to take a run at this and to improve our initiative system in Oregon. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Before you do that, I think I have a couple of people here who have some time constraints. So, Mr.
And
Perry?
I'm one of them, Madam Chair, so if you would excuse me.
But we may need to bring you back for questions.
Okay, I'd be happy to ask Senator Perry Olley.
For the good senator.
This is what I was afraid of.
The demonization of the direct democracy process seems to be a constant theme here. At least I've been hearing it for a couple sessions. And the question I do have for the good senator is there have been some real questions raised about prior restraint. The citizens of Oregon have a constitutional right to participate in government in a direct way in Oregon, and not every citizen in every state has that. It's a fundamental constitutional right in Oregon. There seems to be a concerted effort to throw up as many barriers as possible to citizens participating in direct democracy. And I just wondered if you could talk about the prior restraint argument I've heard in connection with making a 10% signature requirement, or the Constitution says that the ballot title will be drafted before the election. Now you're trying to move this around. Citizens who want to participate in direct government are going to have to incur front-end loaded costs. We would not entertain any discussion of a poll tax or a literacy test for voting. Why should we entertain the idea that citizens have to go out and get 10% of the total requirement of signatures before they can even request the basic service from the secretary or from the state attorney general, which is writing the ballot title? Why is that not a prior restraint?
Well, I think that's a good question. I really think it's a matter of balance. If you went all the way in one direction, you wouldn't require any signatures. You'd allow any citizen to put something on the ballot with a ballot title of their choice. You can go all the way from that direction to from what some states do, just prohibiting it altogether. I think it's a balance. I think the initiative process was intended to address policy issues that for one reason or another could not be addressed in the legislature or were not addressed adequately in the legislature. The legislature is the citizens' first option for changing policy in the state, and it should be. The initiative system, I don't think, is intended to be an alternative government for citizens. It's a form of redress. When the legislature fails to address an issue that's important to the people, I think the initiative process assumes that in order to get on the ballot, an initiative should have widespread public support, hence the signature requirement. If you require those signatures, and again, this wouldn't increase the amount of signatures required, it would just make somebody establish that they are serious with a particular measure, a particular approach, that they are serious and that they have public support before we start these costly wheels of government going on it. And I think that's very legitimate. And again, I did use that successfully myself.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farriello.
I didn't hear anything that addressed the issue of prior restraint, but what I did hear was, a mischaracterization. All of the authority that we have is derived from citizens. We're not the first recourse of citizens. Their citizenship and their vote is clearly preeminent. So I guess I would suggest citizens have a co-equal right to participate in government in a direct way, and anything that we do that restrains that right is on its face unconstitutional, and in terms of at least my values, I think it's just a moral question that we ought to face. We work for the citizens. Very often they don't believe that we're dealing with the issues that are important in a direct way, and they have the constitutional right to do exactly that in a direct way. I think anything that we do that throws up roadblocks, adds additional process. You mentioned Measure 37, Senator. Some communities are putting up all of the prior restraints and roadblocks they possibly can, $1,500 to apply for a process that the law says you don't need any administrative process for. This is the same kind of thing. We don't like the outcomes of direct democracy. Some people hate Measure 11. Some people hate Measure 37. Some people hate Measure 5, and madam, I mean both of them.
Well, so
they're doing everything they can to distance and eliminate direct access for citizens. I'm really sad to see it. I think it's against our obligation to support the constitutional rights of citizens, which is what we all swore to do when we got in the building.
Well, I appreciate that there's a difference of opinion here. I feel very, very good about supporting this measure. I don't think it's a slam of any kind on direct democracy. As I say, I use the system myself as it could be used under either of these bills, and I feel that it was a successful outcome, and I don't share your opinion about what this means.
Madam Chairman,
we
do respectfully disagree.
That's great. I think Senator Burrett needs to go, and one of these two people needs to go as well, and I don't know who has to go first.
She needs to go before I do, but she asked that I go first, so I need to go.
And actually, I think that
my interest in this bill might address Senator Farriello's
And while
question.
We all know who you are,
I was getting to break the record. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Bill Perry. I'm from the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I'm here kind of on the concept. I do like Senator Burdick's other bill better than necessarily 201, and I know Senator Atkinson's smiling. We go around and around on this issue, much of the same points that Senator Farriello raised. So when you look at the concepts under this bill, and I would argue the point that I think it's fairer to citizens from the standpoint of, right now, if you look at Burdick's bill that halts signature gathering once you file for a title, it's not changing the amount of signatures you need. So that is exactly the same. It's not changing the ballot title process stoppage when you turn in your signatures. Actually, I think it makes it more accessible because right now you don't get to use the 25 signatures towards the total. Under this bill, you get to use all the signatures you collect. So all it's really doing is shifting the title process from the beginning to a central point. And I'll explain very clearly why that is important to us. I've never been a chief sponsor. I'm not an attacker, I'm an attackee in this argument. And I would say that there's a lot of different people that are. And the problem that we have is generally, and I got an easy ride this last session, so I don't have the specific examples, but the previous election cycle, I had 12 ballot titles I had to challenge on two issues. And the problem that we have is I think people should have the right to the process. There's no argument to that, but by somebody just collecting 25 signatures, they have really put no expense into the process. Now, a title from a business standpoint challenge costs me anywhere from $1,000 to $9,000. On an average, it's about $2,500, depending on who you got as an attorney. But if I've got to file four of these on one issue or six on one issue, I have now expended a huge amount of time and resources on one issue that the person that's trying to do it has spent very little. So really all I'm trying to get at, and I would say there's many business associations that are in the same, is at what point do I, as somebody that's not the initiator of the issue, have to expend my time and resources? What I would like to see is at least some effort, time, and resources to done before I have to do it. And if they want to go out and do four titles and I have to challenge four titles, at least make them do some time and expense before I have to do that. I do think Senator Burdick's bill that halts the process when you turn in the title is pretty much identical to the way it is today. It's just done at a different point in the process. And, you know, I haven't gone out and collected signatures, nor do I have any plans to do so, but I have to participate in the process a lot more than I do. And I don't think that this is going to make the process more difficult. We still have more ballot measures than any other state. It's the easiest one, in my opinion, to get on as you look across the country. So we're not changing really the ramifications of what you have to do as a petitioner. We're just changing the timeline a bit. So.
Thank you. Ms. Wilmer-Whalen.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, Lori Wilmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I'd like to put on the record that the Oregon Restaurant Association and the Oregon Education Association are in complete agreement. We, too, prefer 933, but we would be fine with 201 as well, if that's your preference. I kind of liken this to the arguments made about frivolous lawsuits and the damage that does to people on the receiving end who have to defend themselves. When ballot title shopping occurs, it is done as a tactical technique to try to get the very best possible language approved and through so that obviously the attacker can prevail. And we, of course, have been on both sides of that equation over the years and certainly have benefited from ballot title shopping as well. I'll say that on the record as well. But we do believe that given the finances of the state and the move for greater efficiency in government and the ability to still protect and preserve the direct democracy our citizens enjoy, but with some rational upfront limits to this tactical endeavor so that the costs by the Attorney General's office are borne only once you get to a certain level of effort. That makes some sense. It's just a practical way to bring some balance to this equation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Ferrielli.
Madam Chair, we've heard the expression that politics makes strange bedfellows, and I think they're three of the strangest I've ever seen. Senator Burdick, the Oregon Education Association, and the Restaurant Association together on an issue makes me cringe, as a matter of fact. It's clear that people don't like the outcomes of some of the initiative process, and I'm certain the Restaurant Association doesn't like the minimum wage mandate, and that's probably what drives them to the table today. I've been very upset, as Ms. Whelan has indicated, Lori Wilmer-Whelan has indicated, because I'm upset and nettled and chagrined and demoralized, in fact, by the fact that an individual with 37 cents can appeal a timber sale that's taken 5 to 7 years to produce with an extreme high expense of an environmental impact statement. But I will suggest to you that those are the rules of engagement, and that people very definitely cherish the right to participate. And there should be, democracy shouldn't have a price of admission. Citizenship is the price of participation, and participation is the goal, and the reward is an engaged, informed, and fully participating citizenry. And your attempt to engineer a prior restraint on citizens' right to participate in direct democracy shouldn't be allowed. The fact of the matter is that you don't like the outcomes. That's tough. I don't like some of the outcomes myself, but those are the rules of engagement. Manipulating the system and trying to do it with a backdoor approach, I believe if you tried to refer this to the citizens, they would thoroughly and soundly trounce this thing. And so you're going to bring it to the legislature and try to bring it out as an improvement to process by demonizing people that participate in direct democracy. I just think it's an abysmal exercise, and I'm embarrassed by the concept. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fairley. Does either one of you wish to respond to those comments?
We'll just let it rest, Madam Chair.
Sarah Atkinson.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I have a few comments. I am passionately against this bill, but I think it has a beautiful relating clause. let's address the real issue. The real issue here is not why is there ballot title shopping? And that's because people don't trust the system. And is it a business? Yes. Am I proud of that fact of it? Absolutely not. I mean, I don't like the fact that this is professional politics with the people system. I don't like that any more than you do. We probably all agree on that. But this doesn't fix the real problem, which is people don't have trust when they submit a ballot title that either a political whoever, Republican, Democrat, but in the last few decades, Democrats, having AGs, officers, Secretary of State, can do anything but waste time or play political games with it. Now, I can say that with some variability simply because I'll just make that a blank comment. You can go back and look at how Bradbury played games at the end of last session to delay the time that people could collect signatures and all that stuff. So I would go back, if I could, even though Senator Burdick is gone, with one thing that she said where she says, I don't think that this is the will of the people or something like that. Let's go back to 1916. Before 1916, this body right here, the Oregon legislative branch, chose United States senators. So what would happen is very big special interests, mainly railroad interests, would come in and help get people like me elected, people in the House elected, and then lean on the elected to get United States senators elected, the ones that they wanted. People did not have a direct contact with that. Oregon was one of the first states not only to pass the initiative process, but also six Oregonians in Oregon City, you could argue, I gladly plead their case, are the ones who, sitting around a dinner table in Oregon, amended the United States Constitution to give every citizen direct election of the United States senators. So the initiative process isn't just another form of direct democracy. It is an equal footing. The people don't serve underneath the legislature. We are their legislature, but it's level. The initiative process is to put them on level with the people that they elect. And so I'm fascinated because everything we do in this building always is trying to make it easier for the government. Go back to the 1960s. Tom McCall, Republican, Attorney General at that time, I forget, Democrat. He was Secretary of State, and they put a false timeline on how long a signature was valid. And we live under that today. It's just, you know, part of our culture. Well, you know, is that really fair? Does that really allow people the time to go out there and not be professional lobbyists or professional people in the initiative industry, but actually go out there and work on an idea when your time frame is completely crunched down? So your signature length of time, because you're just trying to get play by these rules that the government puts on because the government doesn't like the initiative process, doesn't really like the competition. That would be a major reform that we could fit into this little bill here, give it a little purpose, take those time constraints off. We've had ideas throughout my time on the Rules Committee. I'm not done yet.
My understanding is that the two of them had a time commitment.
Well, you know what? I have a time commitment, too, and they're paid to be here, so I'm not done yet.
If you need to go, you can go ahead and leave.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm so sorry, Senator. I'd be happy to continue with your office if you'd like.
Thanks. Sure. But the fact of the matter is that there's other proposals out there where you could have a proponent and an opponent come in and actually have to compromise on what the ballot title is and not go through this long, lengthy process.
This bill does not get at the process of why people don't trust their government. That's why I'm opposed to it.
Okay.
And so if we're just going to put more time constraints on, which is what the Oregon government's done for the last almost 100 years, I'm against it. I don't think it solves anything.
Okay. Do you have any specific suggestions?
You bet. Number one, change the ballot title picking signature process. Get it out of the hands of the Supreme Court. Try to get it out of the hands of the AG, if we can, to the best of our ability, and put both sides down there to each put up five proposals and let's pick one.
Okay.
Number one. Number two, let's get rid of the time constraints that signatures are valid. Either eliminate it or give citizens 2 years unencumbered by politicians to let their ideas gel. But this is not... This just makes it harder. I mean, 25 signatures, yeah, that's a pain. Does it cost business money? Sure. Absolutely. Is it unfair? Yeah, probably. I mean, you could argue that. But I'm not going to do anything that limits citizens' abilities to participate on an equal footing with their legislature. And any time the legislature is going to make a fix, it should be suspect by the people. It was in 1916.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Mr. Perry, it's my recollection, and I don't know whether you were involved in this work group, that there was a work group during the 2003 session to address the concerns, some of the concerns Senator Atkinson raises, and that ended up in the bill, Senate Bill 102. Was the suggestion of having the AG and the Supreme Court out of the ballot title writing business addressed at all during that work group? Do you recall?
For the record, Bill Perry, Oregon Restaurant Association, Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, yes, that was a very big part. And I will say that on the first subject of the ballot title politicized, I mean, like I said, I spent $9,000 on a ballot title, and it was an editorial ballot title. I mean, it was, I think whoever wrote it should have been embarrassed. I'm not going to argue that standpoint. And it was addressed to some sort of a committee address, and I don't think anybody's really got any objections. And I think that from the comments I've heard from the Supreme Court, and by no means do I need to speak with them, I think they've got better uses of their time than to deal with the ballot title process is what I've heard. So I don't think there's any objections to any of that, because I do think that depending on the title, some of them have been very political from my personal perspective, and I agree with them. But that being said, the reason that they are political is one of the reasons why, as a business group, I have to challenge them. And it usually just raises the expense up front for me to have to challenge them. And that really kind of, I think that is the one thing that's kind of the crux of our issue that we agree upon is if it's a political title and somebody, some political interest group other than me, gets to do it for 25 signatures, which is no cost, and it costs me $9,000, it's almost more of a reason to keep doing it, because all they do is see it depleting my resources. And I, you know, to Senator Ferraioli's, I don't think this would have kept minimum wage off the ballot. That is not the reason I'm here. The group that put it on had decided to commit the resources, and nothing in the ballot title process either deterred or encouraged them to do that. The question is that I'm preparing for a fight. Do I have to spend that challenging the six ballot titles they proposed, or can I just deal with the one and start building to a campaign? Because when they file the six titles, I've got six court battles that I'm fighting over here while they're preparing my opposition. It clearly, the system today is set up to where you're in better condition as an offensive measure than you are as a defensive measure. And that's what I think this does bring fairness, because it doesn't change the signatures. It doesn't change the timeline. It moves it. I will acknowledge that, but it doesn't, you know, the challenge process, everything is the same. But it is, the ballot measure process has become an offensive mechanism, and it's now better off for the offensive person than it is the defensive person. And I think Senator Atkinson's point on the titles is completely accurate and valid. But it is, I don't think in all the ballot measures I've been involved with, the people that wanted one on, this would not change, I think, their ability to put it on and off. It might change the way that I react to some of them. But they've either got the resources or they don't, and I don't think this changes that from my personal opinion.
Thank you. Any further questions for this particular witness?
No, Madam Chairman. Just an observation. It sounds like this current system invites people into direct democracy. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli. Thanks, Mr. Perry. Next up, I have Phil Schradl, and I would ask that Heath Garza come on up, please. And I'm sorry, Mr. Schradl, I know you had wanted to testify with Senator Berg. Everyone's time constraints. I'm trying to orchestrate and get people out of here and
that's
get to meetings that they
that's
need
fine.
To.
Members of the committee, Phil Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, Chair Brown, members of the committee. We have proposed Senate Bill 201 basically to start the discussion about ballot titles. We're not wedded to Senate Bill 201, but we do think there are great public purposes behind ballot title reform. And I'd like to take just a couple minutes to try and address the comments of Senator Farrioli and Senator Atkinson. Nothing in Senate Bill 201 nor in Senator Burdick's proposal, Senate Bill 933, is intended to make it harder for anyone to get anything on the ballot. If somebody has an idea that they want to pursue, this doesn't make it any harder at all. What it does do is make them focus on the idea that they want to pursue rather than trying to come up with four or five or six different ways of formulating an idea to see which one, you know, creates or ends up in resulting in what they would view as the best ballot title. What this would really do is focus resources on the ideas that people are really interested in pursuing to the ballot. During the last two election cycles, we've had experiences of about 183 measures two election cycles ago and 152 measures last election cycle, when it ends up that only about, in this last election cycle, 26 of those were ever actually pursued for any signatures at all, and only six of those measures qualified for the ballot. So the idea here is to focus on those that people are actually going to be interested in pursuing through the signature gathering process. Nothing about these processes at all makes it harder to qualify for the ballot. It retains the same number of signatures to qualify for the ballot. And that's not the goal behind the legislation at all. It's simply to focus the expenditure of resources, our resources, Mr. Perry's resources, everybody who participates in the process, on those that actually have support out in the community in terms of an idea that they want to go forward with. That's the idea.
Mr. Schrader, I guess my question is, I mean, some of my frustration with the current process is that folks are requiring the public to subsidize their political efforts in the sense that they're using the system to draft a variety of ballot titles, then polling on those ballot titles, and then moving forward on whichever one moves forward. And I would just like you to respond to that.
Chair Brown, I'm not a psychologist to know what the motivation is behind those efforts, but it does appear to share that that conclusion. I mean, I think we would draw a similar conclusion in that a number of proposals get submitted, and then they never pursue those by going out to gather signatures. It appears that what is going on is that they actually are trying to get something, not focusing on the idea that they want to get before the public, but focusing on crafting a measure that will then get a ballot title that polls the best.
And Senator Farrioli and Atkinson raised the issue of that this is a regulatory interference with the people's right to the ballot, to the initiative process. It's my understanding that there are a number of regulations that petitioners are required to follow, including where people can collect signatures, how signature gatherers can be paid or not paid, those kinds of regulations. There are numerous regulations in place now, are there not?
Chair Brown, that's accurate. How you can go about gathering signatures, where you're able to have your signature gatherers be, you know, whether they have to be registered to be, and they have to follow petition, particular formats of petitions and things like that. There are numerous regulations. Neither of these proposals would address or make those any more onerous than they currently are. The only things that these proposals would do is move the ballot title process to a later point in time.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Yeah, I'm interested in the fact that you're describing a rather dynamic field where, you know, the rules years ago, they change. I mean, we change the way where people can gather signatures. We change, you know, lots of things about the process. How dynamic a process has this whole initiative petition process been since 1905? Have there been a lot of changes? Has it? And what were the biggest changes? I mean, my point in asking the question is that let's look at this in context. Yeah, this is a shift, okay? But haven't there been other big shifts over the over the history of this process? Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Now, I've been in Oregon probably at least nine-tenths of Senator Atkinson's life, if not more. But I grew up in Pennsylvania, where they don't have an initiative process. And it's kind of funny because I sat right behind a kid in high school who was a state senator who spent his career when we both graduated. I came across the country and ended up a senator, and he stayed in Pennsylvania. So we get together once in a while and talk. He's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but we have this 50-year connection. And he said, yeah, it's kind of fun to be in a state where you're elected to represent the people, you know, and you don't have to think about an initiative process overturning, you know. So we've had some interesting conversations about all of that. My question to you, in all of this context, is it is a dynamic thing. What have been some of the biggest changes, and is this any bigger than any of some of the others?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, one of the biggest changes that comes to my mind was one that was dictated actually by a decision of the Oregon Supreme Court about where signature gatherers could obtain signatures. At one point in time, the determination was made that, you know, common areas in shopping centers, for example, were, you know, available sites to gather signatures. A later decision of the court determined that those kinds of sites, like in a Fred Meyer, for example, are not available sites. Now, that has a significant impact because that addresses the capability of gathering the number of signatures to qualify something for the ballot. This measure and Senator Burdick's proposal would not touch that at all. It would not make it harder to get, you would not have to get more signatures to get it on the ballot, nor would you have, the only thing that this does is imposes a kind of a sequencing of events that you gather 10% of the signatures and then you obtain the ballot title, which will be used actually in the voter's pamphlet to educate people about what the measure is when they're voting on the measure at the tail end of the process.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
I just want to push a little further. I'm not sure that would have been the biggest change in my mind. I'd go back another 20 years and we would be in a time when we didn't even have paid petition gatherers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk about a huge change.
Senator,
is this any bigger than that?
Chair Brown, Senator Shields, no. It pales in comparison to that. All that this does is it really affects timing rather than anything else, focuses the resources of the machinery that is engaged in the ballot title process at a later point in time, at which point in time, and we could debate whether 10% of signatures is the right number to, you know, equate that to. The concept behind that threshold is simply to make sure that the resources are expended on measures that people are actually interested in pursuing.
Thank you. Any further questions from Mr.
Yes.
Schradl? Sarah Atkinson.
Don't you believe that time, though, could take off if a citizen, not a special interest group, if a citizen, Citizen Atkinson, retires from the Senate and wants to do something all by himself. And so I start this thing around my idea around a kitchen table, and I'm going to face huge oppositions by well-funded political special interests that are going to outgun me in the courts, are going to outgun me before your agency, you're going to just outgun me. Doesn't it make sense to take some pressure off that with the amount of time that my signatures are valid and let me go around the state and really develop my idea? Doesn't that make more sense to take the pressure off rather than what we've got now is, okay, here we're going to go general election to general election, so let's flood signatures, let's find the ballot title that we want. This is as good as we can get is the decision we make because this bill does not solve the problem of the ballot title. This just makes it easier for government. And then we're going to delay. Okay, we finally got a ballot title, and now we've run the clock down, and we're out of time to collect signatures, so let's run, pay some signatures. It's going to cost $250,000, put it on the ballot, and now go drum up money for the campaign. Doesn't it make more sense to make those signatures valid longer?
and let me work on my idea?
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, that's a very interesting issue. And the purpose behind some kind of a timeline for signatures to be valid is that there's an understanding and a requirement that there be present support for the proposal. I think there could be a very legitimate debate about whether the current two-year period is the right period for signatures to be valid or something longer. That's a different issue, and that's a different debate. And that's a question that, you know, this body could address. Part, you know, you had made reference to an Attorney General opinion a number of years ago. That opinion did not have the insight of the legislative process brought to bear on it because there weren't any statutes that talked about it, there weren't any things that addressed it. The concept behind that opinion was, however, that there needed to be a showing of present support for the measure. And how you define or determine what present support for the measure is, I think is a legitimate issue that could be debated.
Thank you. Please proceed, Senator Atkinson.
Well, wouldn't it make sense if it's 2 years, if that's what we as a legislative body define as legitimate or as valid, current or whatever you said? Wouldn't it make sense that the clock starts once I've got a ballot title?
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, that too could be a legitimate policy choice.
Because we could give this bill some purpose. It would be great. But hold on, one more question, Madam Chair.
Please proceed, Senator Atkinson.
Let's talk about how to restore some faith with the ballot title initiative, with the ballot title process, and maybe regardless of who the Attorney General is and the Secretary of State is and who's in charge of the Supreme Court, couldn't we develop a process by which we actually take away the incentive to shop ballots? I mean, I would agree that it's as much defense as it is offense to, you know, throw the dice with five or six times and hope you get something that polls well. I mean, the business side of it, the other part that Mr. Perry didn't say is when you get five or six ballot titles, it's going to cost $10,000 or $12,000 to poll all those to see where you stand before you pick one. I mean, that's not the people's process. So couldn't we do something where, I know it was talked about before, an opponent comes up with an idea, a proponent comes up with an idea, and somehow we have a clearinghouse that makes a decision and just get the government out of this business?
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, the concern that we have about that proposal is that what you really would be doing is setting up somebody with a vested interest and somebody else with a different vested interest. And wouldn't there be incentive in that purpose or in that process to have people attempt to, you know, shade the use of terms in a way that would favor whether they are for or against the measure? There's some balance about that some other body, you know, we have to choose between what our concern would be potentially between two or three or four bad ballot titles. People have a tendency, and, you know, I don't mean to be defensive about this. The people take issue with, you know, the ballot titles that we draft and the ballot titles that the Supreme Court approves. I submit to you that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Our office does not have a vested interest in the outcome of those ballot title proceedings. We view our role in that as an attempt to draft an accurate and an impartial ballot title. Other people can disagree with whether we have accurately done that. There is, in the current process, the ability to have the Supreme Court review that as well. I believe that they perform their function very well, too. I think it would be a very dangerous road to go down to kind of charge the people who have a vested interest in the outcome on a particular measure with controlling the ballot title that gets attached to that measure, because from all that we have heard, ballot titles can be significant in how the election results come out.
Just to follow up, I'm willing to work. I'm trying to be an equal opportunity offender today. I think if we're going to do an increased amount of signatures, and that makes logical sense. It kind of goes against my grain, but it makes some logical sense. I think we want to devise a way that will make it will change that timeline on when you can actually get a ballot title and get started. Again, I'm not really particularly interested in special interest X or special interest Y having the ability of the system. Maybe I'm being too much of a romantic here. I would like to see if we can't get back to a citizen coming up with an idea and actually going out and working it. Because the professional timelines that this state government has put on it over the last 90 years has taken away the incentive for me to do that, to amend the United States Constitution or anything like that.
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, just a brief remark in response. One of the processes and opportunities that is there for chief petitioners currently is to use the services of legislative counsel to help in drafting measures. I think that there could be some consideration given to make that either more of an encouragement or potentially even, a mandatory requirement. Now, there are some upsides and downsides. For people who think that there's already too much government in the process, that might sound initially as it's a downside. However, some of the measures that come before our office for having ballot titles drafted on them are very inarticulate, and I don't think they actually serve the purpose, the underlying purpose, that the petitioners actually had in mind. So, I would submit that that should be given some consideration. That is outside the scope of the proposal that we're presenting to you today. But if you are looking in a broader-ranging perspective, that might be something to give consideration.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And certainly there's some that come that are on the other side of the spectrum that don't make any sense. I hope I'm looking at the broader perspective. And feel free to come by my office. I'm really interested in this. But, again, I think with a beautiful line two relating clause like this, we could actually do some good.
Thank you, Sarah Atkins. We appreciate your forewarning, the looming forewarning of a minority report.
No, it's
Mr. Schradl, do you have anything further?
Chair Brown, no.
Okay. Mr. Garza, I just actually brought you up because I had a couple of questions. One of the things that happened last session is that some of us came away with the impression that a 20% or 30% of the Supreme Court's time was actually spent on drafting these measures. Could you articulate what your sense of the time consumption these ballot title cases take?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Keith Garza. I'm the senior staff attorney to the Oregon Supreme Court. This will be my fifth election cycle serving the court in that capacity or something like it. The department doesn't have any position on the bill. I'm just here to answer questions. And Chair Brown, your question. I've been before committees like this over successive sessions and in the past had prepared some statistics kind of determining the percentage of the court's written dispositions that were ballot title opinions. In 1997, there were about 11% of the court's total number of opinions written and published were ballot title cases. That raised to 23% in 1998 and 27% in 1999. And since that time, we haven't tracked the statistic the same way. But I would say that with the exception of last election cycle, the numbers have been relatively constant. I think we had 96 cases that were brought to the court for the 2002 election cycle. Let me rephrase that. For the 2000 election cycle, I think there were 92 or so for the 2002 cycle, and last year we had 79 cases. The court has shifted its emphasis from writing opinions in all ballot title cases to only writing opinions in those that present some issue that's worthy of written attention in the reports. And so I think the percentage has gone down, but to the extent that I've heard it said before that 30% of the court's work is ballot title work, and I think that's not accurate. In a particular year, 30% may be the number percentage of opinions that the court has, but work-wise, I would say somewhere between 10 and 15% of the work. And as Senator Burdick had indicated, particularly during late winter and early spring of an election year, ballot title work is the court's primary focus, to the exclusion of other cases.
Does the passage of this bill result in a fiscal savings in terms of the court's time and energy?
Madam Chair, the department has submitted its fiscal impact statement. It indicated no fiscal impact. There would be reduced savings in the court's time. It could devote its efforts to other aspects of its docket. There may be some litigation that would spawn from, you know, implementation of the bill itself, but we would estimate if in fact this were to reduce the number of challenges by 50%. In the past, I've indicated perhaps a rough estimate, maybe $1,500 to $2,000 worth of justice and staff time for each ballot title case on average, realizing they run the gamut from the very simple to the very complex.
Thank you, Mr. Garza. Senator Shields.
I just want to clarify your statement. You talked about it being reduced savings. I don't think that's what you meant.
I probably misspoke. Yes, there would be I guess you could say kind of thin the soup. The amount of work that the court has, keeps the judges and the staff more than busy. The judges and staff would be able to devote their efforts to other aspects of the docket. But we don't, at least to my knowledge and recollection, haven't received any additional funding to do this work. So it would just, we could devote more time to the other aspects of the court's work.
Mr. Schradl, does this bill result in savings to the Department of Justice?
Chair Brown, yes. In our fiscal estimate statement, we submitted a statement that shows almost $200,000 of savings per biennium in terms of our attorney time.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel?
Just a comment. This is very fascinating. I don't think anyone, even any Oregonian, any Republican, Democrat, House, Senate, would think that it's a good use of Supreme Court's time to have this much time wrapped up in it. That's why I really think it is time for us to create some kind of a clearinghouse where the Supreme Court is the last resort of sorts, and I know I'm speaking in big generalities because we've talked about, you know, the horse is probably dead now, but I really am interested in going back to that work group and revisiting those discussions to see if there's not a way to simplify this.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate your time. I would ask that Ms. Kathy Eaton and Mr. Jason Williams come on up. On your way up, we're going to move into a work session on bill introductions and draft introductions, and then we'll come back to you in just a minute. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 201, open a work session on legislative concepts for drafting and for consideration. The chair would move that we would approve the following drafting concepts to be drafted by legislative counsel. Number one, from Senator Modest Anderson, a draft request to allow employers with 50 to 100 employees paying at least 75% of the cost of standard health insurance to establish pools. Number two, from Senator Frank Morris on behalf of the Northwest Y Corps, authorizing cooperative partnership agreements between private, nonprofit, youth development organizations and state of Oregon agencies. Number three, from Senator Westland, a draft request to permit public water systems employees to install backflow prevention devices on service connections to company-owned main lines. Number four, from Senator Westland, a draft request to establish a commission to review Oregon's water code and advise the next legislative assembly on ways to clarify and simplify it. Number five, from Senator Deckert, a draft request proposing the elimination of partisan primaries and establishing one open primary before each election. Number six, from Senator Deckert, a draft Senate joint resolution recognizing the achievements of basketball coach Nick Robertson of Beaverton. Number seven, from Senator Johnson, referring a proposed amendment to the Oregon Constitution changing the number of signatures required to propose initiative laws. Excuse me.
Bless you.
I hope I'm not getting what Senator Shields has. To propose initiative laws, constitutional amendments, or referenda. Number eight, from Senator Ringo, a draft request allowing rapidly growing school districts to designate certain school sites outside of existing urban growth boundaries. Number nine, the request of Jim Long, Blue Pages amending LC 2645 to clearly establish the Public Utilities Commission's authority set standards for telephone directories, and 10, a bill permitting municipalities to impose tax on the retail purchase of telecommunication services, repealing ORS 221.505. And then the following LC drafts for introduction: LC 1470 related to wholesale drug outlets, LC 1690 relating to hearing impaired access program funding, LC 2291 relating to award of public contract based on competitive bids, and LC 2837 relating to intermodal chassis. Any discussion?
Please give the two caveats, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. For the record, your vote today is a courtesy simply for the purposes of drafting and bill introduction. It does not signify support or opposition to any or each of these measures.
Madam Chair, that's only one caveat. I said two caveats.
Senator Atkinson, what's the second one?
These bills in no way will lengthen the time of the legislative session.
Senator Atkinson, I can guarantee you that these bills will in no way lengthen the legislative session. So, would the committee assistant please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson.
Yes.
Senator Ringo. Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli, Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. The chair thanks both of you for your courtesies. And with that, we're going to close the work session on drafting requests and bill introductions and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 201. Ms. Eaton, Mr. Williams, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Senator Atkinson. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm going to bring you a little different perspective that the League has on Senate Bill 2001. We're a staunch supporter of direct democracy in Oregon. As participants in a number of petition drives, we understand the process and we support the concepts proposed in Senate Bill 2001. For some time, the League has been a proponent of providing a means of public discourse on a proposed initiative before it qualifies for the ballot, and that's our concern with 2001. To accomplish such discussion, we are in support of either requiring a significant increase in the number of signatures on a prospective petition before it's filed, or a requirement to collect a significant number of signatures prior to the receipt of a ballot title. Other methods could include a review process for each initiative with public hearings, or the indirect initiative process where petitions which qualify for the ballot would go to the next legislative session for review and possible action before being referred to the voters. These are all options which are used in other initiative states, and there are 26 initiative states. We certainly are cognizant of the improvement to the system that 201 would have with regard to ballot title shopping, but our concern is having the ability to talk about what the issue is before it goes on the ballot. The 10% of qualifying signatures requirement prior to gaining a ballot title certainly would give signees or proposal signees to the petition the opportunity to ask questions about the statute or the constitutional amendment, but it would also give the initiative proposers the opportunity to assess public support or opposition, as well as collecting signatures that count toward the total. So the point has already been made by others that this gives proposers of initiatives the opportunity to go forth and collect part of their signatures before they get the ballot title. That, to us, seems to be a plus for both people who are interested in getting it on the ballot and people who are interested in finding out what it's all about. So we feel that 201 brings forward the idea and the possibility of the public getting to know about what a ballot measure is all about in the signature gathering before there is a ballot title.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association. We're in opposition to this bill, and when it came up last session, there was strange bedfellows that did oppose this bill. You had the environmental groups and liberal folks like Dan Meek and Lloyd Marbette teaming up with Don McIntyre and Oregonians in Action. So there's a wide variety of people that do not want to see these type of barriers be put into the initiative process. We feel like, especially with this idea, you're actually transferring the burden and creating a greater burden, because it will increase not only for the petitioners, because now they will have to go out and spend more time in the process, in the initial process, but you also have the Secretary of State's office that has to go and verify all those signatures before they go through that second ballot title process, and also the Supreme Court, which, if you're going to go through the trouble of getting that 10,000, you will push more people into the Oregon State Supreme Court to, you know, fight or die for a decent ballot title. The other thing, issue is that you're really opening up for all kinds of problems. If you allow someone to go out on the street with an idea, with a temporary title, and they're out there gathering signatures, 10,000, which would be, you know, what needed for a constitutional, and then suddenly they have to change that ballot title after they get that 10,000, and then they go out and they hit some of the same people, and they're thinking it's a different measure, really a different ballot title. So they're, you know, inclined to sign it again. So you're actually, you know, it's almost like an invitation for people to sign and give duplicate signatures. I mean, that to me is the most chaotic thing about this whole thing, is that you're actually sending out a petition where you're switching the look of the petition midway. You know, talk about ballot title shopping. I don't think it's as big of a problem as people make it to be. Now, I will have to make a midnight confession. I have actually submitted duplicate measures to the Attorney General's office for a ballot title. It was a capital gains tax cut. But the only reason why I did it is because one had a date to be in effect this year, and the other one had a date to be in effect that year. It wouldn't take the Attorney General's office more than 10 minutes of their time to make the difference. But do you really expect me, is it really fair for me to go out and get 10,000 signatures on each measure just to show that I'm serious about this, or to make me, you know, cross that burden? You don't know when you file a petition whether the legislature is going to pass what you want or what the state of the economy is. So there's reasons why people will submit duplicate petitions. And sometimes they submit duplicate, and it's from the session before or the previous election cycle. So it's not that much of a labor. And I know that there's talk about ballot title shopping for pollsters' reasons, but really what we see as important is clarity and fairness. And if you don't have a ballot title that's fair or clear, you've got to do something. And right now there's two options. One is you fight it in court, or two is you try to understand where the Attorney General is coming from and try to understand their philosophy and their principles, and you may have to give it another try and to adjust your petition to be in harmony with the Attorney General. Well, if we set up this huge barrier, you're saying, forget that. Attorney General gets what he wants. You either go fight in the courts. We would feel there'd be an option. And when I talk about how many measures, there's only 31 measures that have been draft measures that have been filed. That's not a lot. 31. So it's crazy to make. And if all these 31 had to go out and get 10,000 signatures, you know, you're talking over 250,000 signatures would have to be gathered, run through the elections office, and most likely, and then run all those things through the Supreme Court. So, for me, 31 draft ballot titles at this point, and we're almost 1 year into it, it is very well worth the cost. And so those are the avenues that we bring up in saying this really creates way more problems than it helps.
Mr. Williams, I think you actually raised some very good points. Your comment suggests that you think this will shut out grassroots efforts. I guess it's my sense that it's not the grassroots efforts that are filing the 6 to 8 ballot titles on a single subject. Wouldn't you agree with me on that?
It may be. Okay. I haven't looked at it, but that is the point. It is the small guys who don't have the legion of attorneys and whatnot. And we've seen some great ballot measures come just from some folks gathering in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. My other concern is trying to be more fiscally responsible is that, you know, we're having taxpayers basically subsidize the ballot title
shopping process. Why do you think taxpayers should subsidize that process?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, taxpayers are subsidizing democracy. It's not the process. I mean, look, we have unelected administrators making rules that could wreck someone's financial life. They have to hire their attorneys. They have to get all stressed out about it and be at these hearings and be here and be all over the place. But when it comes to the people wanting to come up with an idea, I mean, that's democracy. So I don't consider it a subsidy.
Okay, thank you. Sarah Atkinson? All right. Thank you both very much. We appreciate you being here today. Anybody else in the audience wishing to testify? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 201. And I believe there's no further business to come before the committee. We're adjourned.
I thought I'd keep it a second.
Yeah.